session for today before the council meeting later on this afternoon. And it's on the Registrar Accreditation Agreement, which will be known as the RAA, as you can see. This session came about because there has been quite a lot of work going on in the GNSO and the ALAC group looking at the RAA. There was a final report issued in October. You may have missed it. It was 179 pages long. So clearly a lot of work gone into that report. And talking about the registrant rights and responsibilities and potential changes to the Registrar Accreditation Agreement. And so we thought it may well be of interest to this community as well. Not all of us have registrars, of course. Many of us also have resellers, but most of us do have registrants, and therefore that would be relevant. We're going to start off, because Margie is time-constrained, with an introduction as to where we are now in the final report. But before I do that, let me just introduce the panel.
Thank you, Leslie. Good afternoon, everyone. It's nice to be with you. My name is Staten Hammack. I'm the Senior Director of Law and Policy at Network Solutions, a U.S.-based domain name registrar, and Network Solutions is a member of the Registrar Stakeholder Group.
Michaeli Nayland from Black Knight, a registrar based in Ireland.
My name is Mason Cole. I'm with Oversea, and we own several registrars. I'm also chair of the Registrar Stakeholder Group.
I'm Roelof Meijer, the CEO of SIDN, and SIDN is the registry of .nl, the Dutch CCTLD.
Hello, everyone. I'm Margie Mile. I'm a senior policy counselor at ICANN, and I'm going to provide you do you want me to go ahead and start? Yes. Okay. I'm going to provide you an overview of the final report that Leslie mentioned. It is a very large report. Represents a lot of work that was done in the community with regard to these issues, and I thought I would start with giving you a background of how the report was generated. As many of you may recall, in 2007, a process was kicked off to do a comprehensive review of the RAA, and this stemmed from the Registrar-Fly situation when Registrar-Fly became terminated and their accreditation was terminated. There was a lot of questions regarding, you know, whether the agreement was sufficient to address all the kinds of issues that stemmed from that situation. So Paul Toomey initiated a process basically directing staff to work with registrars to come up with a new form of RAA. And that form of agreement was developed in the 2008-2009 timeframe and was eventually approved by the GNSO Council in 2009. This was, I believe, the Mexico City meeting last year. Prior to the approval of the new RAA, there were some concerns in the community that the community issues had not been fully addressed and that the community did not have an opportunity to participate adequately in the process. So as part of the approval of the new form in 2009, the GNSO kicked off a new procedure with the at-large community to take further look at the RAA to see if additional improvements could be made to the RAA, and I'll get into that shortly. So since 2009, the working group was comprised of members of the GNSO community and the at-large community. A report was published for public comment, and that led to the October report that I have provided a link for here. So essentially what the working group took a look at was it tried to do three tasks. The first task was to draft a charter that was comprised of the registrant rights and responsibilities. And this stemmed from an at-large request to try to provide more information to registrants. And the report actually has language that includes an inventory of the obligations in the RAA that relate to registrants and also the responsibilities. The second task was to identify potential topics for amendments to the RAA. The group did not look at these amendment topics as ones that had to be done. It was more topics to be explored further. So I just want to clarify, when you look at the report, they're not recommendations from the work team that these be adopted, but that they be explored. And then finally, the working group also was asked to identify a specific process and timeline to move forward with these improvements to the RAA. So the first part of the report just basically had this Registrant Rights and Responsibilities Charter, and essentially what it did is it took a look at the existing agreement and identified all the provisions in the RAA that dealt with registrant rights and responsibilities. And we tried to draft this document in a form that was simple language so that it didn't sound like, you know, legalese, something that a registrant could look at and easily understand the rights and the responsibilities that relate to registrants. And then the report also identifies the next steps for this particular Registrant Rights and Responsibilities Charter, which is to go ahead and begin a consultation process with the registrars so that they can eventually link to this and so that registrants can have a place to access this information. And this is something that's currently an obligation in the RAA. The RAA right now, Section 3.15 basically says that if a form of a Registrant Rights and Responsibilities Charter is developed in consultation with registrars, that the registrars would link to it. And this is just meant to provide more information to registrants. In this process, the at-large community produced something else that's called an aspirational charter. And this was meant really to be something that included perhaps rights that are not, you know, currently in the RAA, but are rights that believed that the at-large community believed should be afforded to registrants. And although the working group did not have consensus and was not asked to address that particular issue, the report notes that this work is ongoing within the at-large community. The main part of the report, really, and the most of the work that was done, related to coming up with topics for additional amendments to the RAA. And so the idea being that a new form of RAA could be adopted and that these are topics that are to be explored further to see whether they can be incorporated in the RAA. And what you see here, there's 12 items. On the next slide as well, there's an additional six, so a total of 12. They're not ranked. So in other words, number one is not more important than number two. There's just 12 of the topics that the working group felt deserved high priority. And what happened was, and during this year process, the working group solicited inputs from various parts of the community. So, for example, the law enforcement community came and developed amendment topics and presented them to the working group, and some of those law enforcement amendment topics are incorporated into some of these recommendations. The IPC submitted proposal topics that related to intellectual property issues, for example. The at-large community also had various input to come up with a list which totaled, I believe, 150 different topics that got whittled down to this high priority list. And if you look at the items, you can see they vary from all sorts of topics, like the first one deals with prohibition on registrar cyber squatting. That's one that the group felt should be explored. Malicious conduct, there's a priority that it should be a registrar duty to investigate an instance of malicious conduct. That was something that felt was to be high priority. There's also a notion that there should be a designation and publication of a technically competent point of contact for malicious conduct issues. And the working group suggested that it be 24/7, so 24 hours a day, 7 days a week is what the topic for further exploration. There's also a notion that there should be disclosure regarding privacy or proxy services that are made available by a registrar. And the additional recommendation that of a topic to be explored further is that the registrars would be responsible for compliance for such services. And there's also additional information related to proxy and privacy services and related to cancellation of registrations when there is noncompliance. So these are, you know, it's hard to go through each of these, but you can see that they explore various, you know, aspects of registrar business and services. And this is on this slide, we have the second set of high priority items, including things such as defining circumstances where a registrar would be required to cancel a registration for a false who is information. There's a notion that registrars should be compliant with the PCI process. Was that the credit?
It's to do with credit card security.
Okay, credit card
security. It's the standard that Visa, MasterCard, and several of the other acquirers would use.
That's right. That's right. Some suggestion that there should be definitions of what reseller is and to clarify the responsibility for reseller compliance. And then there's also a series of recommendations that relate to disclosure of registrar contact information and information regarding the form of business that the registrar is and their officers. And so it was a notion that additional information regarding the registrar business would be made available. And then finally, the final high priority topic was the clarification of registrar responsibilities in connection with UDRP proceedings. A notion that when a UDRP decision comes down, what would be the steps followed by the registrar? So again, just to highlight, these are just topics for further exploration. They're not the working group did not recommend that each of these become part of the RAA. The next set of topics were medium priority topics, and these I'm not going to go through all of them, but you can see they are topics that have been discussed a lot in the community, topics that they felt should be explored, but not as high priority as the ones that I mentioned earlier. Things like if there's a false who is data, that the process for verifying information if there's been a false who is report, could be clarified. Requiring links to the Who Is problem reporting system on the registrar's homepage. A suggestion that there be a service level agreement on Who Is availability. A disclosure of whether of the resellers of a registrar and resellers to disclose the registrar that they use. There's also some amendment topics that came from ICANN staff. ICANN compliance staff was involved in this process and suggested additional clarifications that might help when they need to terminate an accreditation. And so there's some information related to that. And also information related to streamlining the arbitration process and in cases of deaccreditation. And so, I won't go through all of these, but this gives you a flavor of the topics that were discussed in the community and that are viewed as a medium priority and not high priority. So the next steps with regard to this process is that the report essentially identifies the discussion that was undertaken in the working group. And just to point out that in the working group, there was no consensus on what the next steps should be. There was a strong support position that the next process should include observers in the negotiation process. And what we mean by observers is that it would be representing the non-affected, non-parties, essentially the parties being ICANN and the registrars. And so the strong support position was that there should be some observers in this process. There was substantial opposition from the registrars that it would not be appropriate to have observers in the negotiation process, but that there be a mechanism to provide regular reports. And then there were also some sub-team members that felt that third parties should be full participants in the negotiation of coming up with the next form of RAA. And so that was where there was a disagreement within the working group. The rest of the steps in the report are ones where both sides had general agreement. There was consensus on the rest of the steps, just not on the negotiation process. And so what I have posted on this slide is the steps. They're fairly detailed, but essentially it starts off with this list of topics going to the GNSO Council and that there be a process for filtering out topics that may include consensus policy. I mean, if you take a look at the topics that are listed on the slides, some of them appear to be more policy-related, like new policies as opposed to clarification of contract language. So that's the step that's being suggested in this process. And then there would be this negotiation process to begin with a negotiation group, and that's where the differences lie and who would be involved in this negotiation. And then as this negotiation proceeds, there's the notion that there should be a separate process to allow the registrars to have an executive session with the staff so that if they have business concerns that they don't want to air out in the larger group, they could do so, with staff just one-on-one. And so there's that's part of the recommendation that there would be this executive session. And then there would be reports going back and forth. Eventually, you would get to the point where staff and registrars, in consultation with observers, would determine when the full form of the REA is ready for public comment. And then it would go to the GNSO Council. The GNSO Council would review this and vote on approval of the REA, noting that a supermajority would be needed to be achieved in order for the new form to be approved. And then if the form was approved by the council, it would go to the board for approval. So essentially, that's the process. I'm happy to take any questions, or Leslie can turn it over to you.
Thank you, Margie. So it's going to be in the next few weeks then? What is the timeline?
The timeline is today the council is voting on a motion to approve Process A. Process A is the process that included the observers. It's unclear that it will pass today. And so if it doesn't pass, then I assume the GNSO Council will have to reevaluate and decide, what other motion they would like to, adopt. But I think it's a fairly long process in the sense that as you go back through these steps, you'll see that there's a lot of additional work that still needs to be done, such as, doing this analysis of whether it falls within consensus policy or not, and then this negotiation process. I don't, have a good handle for how long it'll actually take to go through these issues.
Okay, thank you. Right, we're going to move on to a discussion around what that means for us and the issues. But before we do that, any immediate questions for Margie? No? Okay, I know you've got a rush, so thank you very much for spending some time with us. Thank you. Okay, so on to Roloff. Is this an interesting parallel universe that we just need to be aware of, or are there implications for CC agreements between registries and registrars?
Well, I think there are implications because even we have ICANN accredited registrars among our registrars, so for them it will have implications. I don't think there will be a direct influence on the contracts or the terms and conditions of the contracts that we have with our registrars under .nl.
Enough. Okay. So for the next session, we're going to move on to a panel discussion where I have you've got a presentation?
Yeah, I was asked to present. Yeah?
Okay, sorry. Okay.
I didn't know it was
summarizing briefly.
I don't have a presentation in the sense that I have slides, but I was asked to cast some light on the CCTLD perspective with regard to registrars. Just to give you some background information, we have about 4.2 million domains now in .nl. We have just under 2,000 registrars. The number of them is slowly declining, mainly due to the economic circumstances at the moment. Out of those 2,000, there are less than 10 ICANN accredited. That number is slightly increasing, and there's a kind of a strange development. Our largest registrars are all of Dutch origin, but the top four now is all ICANN accredited. And then we have the, let's say, international ICANN accredited registrars like Tukaus, and they are somewhere in our top 100, but by far not the largest that we have. We have a triangular contractual situation under .nl, which means that the registry has a contract with the registrar, and the registry has a contract with the registrant, and of course the registrar has a contract with the registrant. The contract between the registry and the registrant is the responsibility of the registrar to handle. And in the way he does that, we leave it fairly open to him, as long as he can prove that the registrant has agreed with the terms and conditions of the registrant contract, so the contract between the domain name holder and SIDN in this case. The contract that we have with our registrars mainly deal with, of course, they have to pay us to be a registrar. It's about 200 and a bit euros per quarter, so just over 800 euros a year. They have to adhere to certain terms and conditions. The most important ones deal with how they should act on behalf of the registrant. And a very important clause is that they cannot do any transaction in the name of the registrant without the registrant's authorization. And that's a ground for cancellation of the contract, so termination of the registrar as in the sense of being a registrar. The registrar is also responsible for providing us with accurate data on the registrant, and he's also responsible for keeping that data accurate. We don't ask proof for that every time, but we check every now and then. If we come across out-of-date data or clearly falsified data, that can have strong repercussions on the registrar. And, of course, it will lead to cancellation of the domain name. There are several clauses on app use of our system, so a registration system, but also on the app use of our Whois. And there is a very broad clause in the contract with the registrar that says that the chief executive of the registry always has the authority to one-sidedly change the registrar contract. He hardly ever does that, but he has that possibility. All in all, I think it's a far lighter contract than between ICANN and ICANN accredited registrars, because there's not really anything in the sense of accreditation. You can speak for that because you're one of our registrars, but there's a very, very low threshold to become a registrar on the .nl, and I think that's the main reason why we have so many. It's probably also a contributing factor in why we have so many domain names under .nl, and it hasn't led to low quality services being offered, all kinds of problems within the .nl namespace. On the contrary, yeah, I would say there's ample choice, there's fierce competition, prices vary broadly, and in general, I think it's a good situation. Well.
Thank you. Thank you, Rolf. Sorry, I cut you off short earlier.
Nope.
Okay, we're going to move to a panel discussion, which will be moderated by Mr. Mike here, who's just going to get the mic.
Mr. Mike,
So a panel discussion. So what proposals do you support? Do you think the proposals have gone too far? What elements do you think should be incorporated in country code agreements? Let's discuss.
Yes, discuss. Marks out of 10 later. Well, I think it'd be a good way to start to just get the you three guys to have a couple of minutes each and just tell us what you think about this and the process and so on. Is that okay with you? Are you happy to do that? Go ahead. Whichever order you prefer.
Well, we'll defer to you, Mason.
Yeah. Okay, Mason's going first.
Thank you very much. What do registrars think about all this? Well, I think we should back up a bit to go back to 2001 when our first accreditation agreement came into force, and the reality of the situation is the agreement had not been amended the entire time, really, between 2001 and 2009 when we did a round of amendments. Most registrars are now operating under the 2009 contract. There are provisions in that contract that call for all manner of things, additional registrar training, different sorts of issues on security. We're now subject to a data escrow program where, to maintain our accreditation, we're required to deposit all of our users or our customers' information into data escrow in the event of a technical failure or the failure of a business. So the realities and the practicalities of operating a registrar now are far different from what they were in 2001, and so is the marketplace. The marketplace is far more competitive. In 2001, GoDaddy still had – GoDaddy, which is the largest ICANN-accredited registrar by far, was – I'm not even sure they were in existence yet. But if they were, they were very small, and there weren't that many registrars. There are now 968 accredited ICANN-accredited registrars. So with that as context, I'll candidly tell you that registrars are having difficulty with many of the issues here, not only with the issues themselves, but with the process that's being used to put them into place. We're very concerned that the community misperceives the RAA as a policy document, which it's not. There's a difference between creating policy and implementing policy. And on our side of the world, the generic name support organization is a policy-making body. I think some in the community misperceive the GNSO as something that it's not. They instead of perceiving it as a policy-making body with a policy development process function, it's being perceived as a contract authority. Usually, policies developed, it may be put into the contract, and it's the contract is a memorialization tool between the contracted parties. So we're having difficulty, I think, with that perception. Now, registrars are extremely interested in making sure that they cooperate with not only everyone in the community, but make life easy for our customers. As I said, it's highly competitive. Many registrars, in fact, I don't think I'm inaccurate in saying this, make very little money, if any, on the registration transaction itself for a domain name registration. We wholesale a name from the registry at whatever rate, let's say $5, and after you take the costs of acquiring a customer and maintaining all of our systems and hiring people and what have you, chances are pretty good we're not going to make any money on that transaction because it's so competitive. If we don't compete on price, we don't acquire customers very easily. So it's very competitive, and the amendments, I don't know. I'm having one of those deals where my brain wants to go 8 different directions. So I'm sorry. Back to your original question. We're having difficulty with some of the we're having difficulty with some of the amendments. We're certainly having difficulty with the process. All that said, we're looking to cooperate with the community to make sure that reasonable expectations can be set on both sides.
Okay. Cool. Briefly. Don't fight. Just talk.
No, I'll talk. Mason has covered a lot of the entire process side of things, which the registrar community are having difficulties with. So I think I'll just look more at the actual topics themselves, since I think that's probably of more interest to this group, since that's kind of what we're looking at. I mean, the topics that people have raised that they want to get registrars to implement, and they want us to be bound by them. As Mason said, using the RAA to beat us over the head may not be the best way to do it, but getting it into position where we're actually doing it uniformly, be that through some other means or not, in many cases it isn't really an issue, and it shouldn't be. I mean, there's things like various prohibitions, the things like the PCI compliance for registration processes. Since most of us sell online, most of us accept Visa. Visa is basically telling us all we have to be PCI compliant anyway, so we're doing that. Disclosing information about our corporate structures for European companies is a no-brainer. We have to do it anyway. Some of the other things have been brought to us by law enforcement and various other bodies. And the unfortunate thing there is it's a matter of communication. They may be asking us for one thing because they have a specific goal in mind, but what they're asking us for probably won't actually help them. Whereas what they really need to do is actually engage in a dialogue with us so we can actually work together to achieve that goal. So that with that in mind, law enforcement has been meeting with the registrars to build up on a better level of communication, and there is a meeting coming up towards the end of February, Mason? Mm-hmm. Towards the end of February in Brussels. And the reason I raise that is because several of you are from CCTLD registries within Europe, and both yourselves and your registrars are being encouraged to attend that meeting, because this is a global problem. I mean, they were talking about abuse of the DNS, so it's not just a case of Arisha will fix it with the GTLDs and the CCs are all fine, or vice versa. Some of the things that people are asking about, I personally, speaking for my own registrar, I don't have any real issue with it. But when you're dealing with 900 plus accreditations, you're dealing with companies from the four corners of the globe, it's not that easy, because you're going to have you have people in certain countries where they don't use credit cards. So expecting somebody to comply to a credit card acquiring system, which they're not even using, is a bit unreasonable.
It's the bicycle helmet argument. You can go and choose your registrar that's got credit card compliance, but health and safety people say that should be mandated. You can choose to wear a bicycle helmet, but the health and safety people say it should be mandated. Staten.
My two colleagues have covered quite a bit, but I'll just add, by underscoring one of the things that Mason said, is that as registrars, we try to engage concerns with the different groups directly, as opposed to waiting for an RAA to impress something on us. I have to give credit to Mason for organizing the registrars to engage law enforcement, the intellectual property constituency, and other groups, and ALAC and others that have had concerns. And we try to emphasize that if you'll just come to us with those topics and concerns, we'll do our best to address them there without having to create a document or a process to deal with the issues.
Okay, can I see if I can? There's some interesting bits and pieces in there that are first of all, I'm not challenging your comment, but it's an interesting thought. You've quite rightly, our registrars would say that the profit margins are very low. And just so that you know, we have, because Australia is perhaps best described as policy rich in the domain name game, we have, I think, 33 registrars or 34 registrars. We have God knows how many resellers, but 33 or 34. And they would all say that the profit margin is low. In the case of the GTLDs, how do you explain the fact that if the profit margin is so low, there are 968 of you? I mean, could it be that some of those 968 perhaps are not performing the services of registrars, unlike you?
Yes, I can explain that number. There are 968 worldwide. Some of those are very tiny operations, one to two people. And maybe they have, you know, a handful of registrations. Others are enormous, like GoDaddy or Network Solutions. Some of those registrars were created specifically to facilitate what's been called the domain name aftermarket, that help acquire names and then make them available to people who maybe missed a registration the first time and would like another shot at it. And registrars very often sell other services. So the accreditation for selling domain names may only be a sliver of their business. They make their money on other services.
Okay.
Yeah.
Is there an element of there's a bunch of bad guys, and you get the problems because of the bunch of bad guys?
I mean, look, the domain registrations, hosting, and all those services, their business is like any other. Like any other sector, you're going to have companies who engage in activities that are not exactly kosher. I mean, within the registrar community, there's 900-plus accreditations, which, when broken down, comes down to, I think, about 300 actual separate entities. Then you have resellers, you have companies engaged in all sorts of different things. And sure, you get one or two who might do things in a rather odd manner, who you know, tar the rest of us with a bad name. It's the same, though, in the .au namespace.
Yeah,
I mean, you're just after coming out the far end of a rather interesting court case involving one of your registrars.
Indeed.
So, you know, it's the same everywhere.
Okay. This is supposed to be everybody, so questions and comments are very welcome. Please raise your hand. I know my friend Nigel over there wants to say something, and Roloff does. Nigel?
Thank you. And in line with what Chris has just asked me to do, I will be very brief.
I never said a word.
You just raised your eyebrow. What I'm concerned about, and what happens in GSpace, if only by example and influence, does affect what happens in CC space, is the requirement on the business model of registrars over who is in privacy services. Now, I realize that there has been an example of one example, which is Registerfly, of a difficulty caused by a registrar-run privacy service. But the idea that you can legislate in contracts with registrars that a registrant can't keep his data private, or if he does, you infringe on that privacy in some way by requiring, what were those services, Relay and Reveal, I spotted there, concerns me a little bit, because at the end of the day, if somebody wants to keep their data private, they list their law firm there and it's covered by legal privilege. That's actually just making privacy services available only to the rich.
Sure. Okay.
So I'd like anyone to hear what the registrars would say.
Anybody want to say anything? Would you rather keep it private?
Well, I mean, I don't disagree.
Can you just get clear that you can just talking personally? It's fine.
We're
all talking personally. It's not a problem.
I agree with everything Nigel said. I mean, we have a private registration services, and we think there's users out there for good reasons would like that service, and so that's why we offer it, and we believe it should be available.
Rolf, you had a comment.
Yeah, it was on your question. I think you said something like suffering for the bad guys. I'm not an expert on the accreditation amendments, but I think that's a bit what is happening. You see it very often in more or less, well, it's probably typical for bureaucratic organizations that if they have to choose between going after the bad guys, the few bad guys, or making rules to prevent the bad guys from, or trying to prevent the bad guys from being bad guys, they choose the latter. It's easier because you go back into your office, you come up with rules, and you apply them to everyone. And it was a bit like that with SIDN as well. And a couple of years ago, we decided to be more trustful towards our registrars and lighten the contracts, but be stronger on checking if they were living up to the agreement and acting on individual basis towards registrars that were not. And I think that's far more effective. And we have to deal with 2,000 of them, and I can have to deal with only 900 or 1,000. Should be an easier job because they're, I don't know how many more people they have than we have, but quite a lot, and definitely a lot more lawyers. So,
Martin?
Thanks, Chris. Just trying to pick up on the point about margins and the low-cost element of the business, and then also the point that Michele made about there being some organisations that really are perhaps rather small and not doing a very good job, and therefore perhaps also undercutting you because they're not adopting the same sort of standards. My question, I guess, is about establishing a sensible level playing field which gives a degree of confidence for the business that then everybody has to apply. And then, picking up on Roloff's comment, that you've got a requirement or a fairly strong enforcement process so that you do not then have a race to the bottom in standards. So the question really is, by setting those standards, are you not actually going to put yourselves as registrars in a rather more healthy position than if you don't actually have the standards or if you're letting the standards lapse?
Well, that was an interesting question, I suppose. In many respects, yeah. The better the industry behaves, the better the standards are within the industry, then obviously the better for all of us. But whether or not that is something that should be mandated through contracts or more a case of us improving our own self-regulation is something which I suppose is still a bit of an open question. I mean, you've seen me talk at various other fora on various topics around policy and self-regulation is something I do strongly believe in. I mean, in terms of when it comes to the price thing, in the UK namespace, you have registrars offering COUK registrations now for 99 pence for 2 years, that kind of price, and maybe even below that. So obviously people are competing on more than just price. I mean, you're competing based on service, you're competing based on, I don't know, the extra extensions you carry, the other services that you might offer, better customer service, a whole range of different things. But the thing, of course, is that that isn't going to work for the community, because they're looking for the warm fuzzies, they're looking for the assurances that everybody can get the same kind of levels of security and levels of stability. And this, at some point, I suppose, you have to kind of say, well, no, that's not really possible. It is going to come down to a consumer choice. But I suppose the thing we really need to work towards is getting things to a point where they can make an educated choice, which, oddly enough, would, going back to Australia, as Chris knows, I spend a lot of my time on conference calls with one of his colleagues. In the Australian space, they produced a website which was aimed to give consumers that education and give them the information to be able to make that choice. And maybe that's an area that we need to spend more time on, rather than putting the registrars on the back foot in a defensive position.
You sure? Okay. So, one sec. So, should it be funded? Forget the change in the contract, etc. Just take it where it's take us of where we are. Should it be easier or harder to become a registrar?
Well, it depends on what your ultimate goal is. When the registrar function was created in the first place, it was meant to introduce innovation and competition into the domain name space. ICANN didn't want the competition only to be at the top level with the registries. So if your objective is encourage technical innovation and economic expansion, then standards in general would need to be a bit lower in order to encourage more applicants. If your ultimate objective is prevent and dissuade every type of bad behavior that could be done under the guise of a domain name, and mandate that the registrar be the largest part of that enforcement effort, then raise your standard.
Okay. Did anyone? Did you like Rolf?
Yeah, I doubt if that letter relation, if that really exists, because our standards are, our contractual conditions are easy to meet, and .NL is one of the safest domains, and the high risk zones are the GTLD zones.
Yeah, that's true.
So I don't think that relation is there, that if the threshold of becoming a registrar is higher, that the zone will be safer.
Well, I think there's a slight difference here, because in the CCTLD space, you're all thick. I mean, as in thick registries in the tech.
I wasn't taking any offense.
So in the difference is within the G space that the two biggest extensions, COM and NET, are thin. So that means that the registrar function includes a much higher barrier technically if you're going to run your own backend. Whereas if in the C space, you don't have to worry about that. I mean, you want to get accredited in COUK, you sign a contract with Leslie's organisation, you pay them, I think it's about £450 sterling, set up, and that's it, you're done. For .NL, you have a slightly higher technical barrier, but it's not exactly rocket science. I mean, you just do it. I mean, other registries, as I look around the room, they have various different criteria. You can get accredited, but then you might have to go through a technical accreditation before you go live. But it's we're talking about slightly different environments. Now, coming back to the original question, raising or lowering barriers, I don't think that's really an issue. I mean, the barrier that exists to become an ICANN accredited registrar at the moment, it's reasonably high. It's not ridiculously high, because we managed to get there, so I think that makes me happy. But it wasn't so easy, and it isn't so easy, that anybody can just, you know, pick up and just start to become a registrar in the morning with absolutely nothing behind them. You have to have a certain degree of financial stability, a certain degree of technical competency, or find somebody to help you who has all that.
Okay. Yeah, hi, it's Mike Stewart from CIRA. I just wanted to pick up on some of the earlier comments. There's been obviously a lot of focus on making the RA a lot more intrusive and longer. Do you, from a registrar perspective, get a sense that there's an issue on the compliance or enforcement side that ICANN's trying to make up for some issues there by kind of front-end loading their agreements with even more obligations?
I don't think ICANN's trying to make up for that, frankly. I think, as Margie said, the community wanted far more extensive revisions to the contract the first time around, and they didn't get everything that they wanted, and so this is step two in that process. With regard to compliance, I'm glad you brought that up. ICANN's compliance effort is robust and is getting even more so. They have open requirement positions for three additional staff on their compliance team. We are regularly audited under the terms of our contract on various issues. They're very good with compliance. So and it should be so. We believe that should be the case.
I've got a question from Gabby from Jonathan at the back, and then Matthew. Do you have a thought about why? What's the behavior or numbers of behavior out there in the world of registrars with customers that's making the customers, as represented by whoever they may be, the ALAC or whatever, come and say, do this? I mean, just to take an example, is it that some registrars make it extremely difficult for people to transfer their names to another registrar, you know, and they end up having to renew with the existing registrar? Because this comes from somewhere. I'm not saying it comes from one place. It comes from lots of things. But is there behavior in the marketplace that's making this happen?
Well, one of the things that compliance shared with the three of us just recently was that the largest percentage of their complaints have to do with transfers requests. So specifically to your question, that is one of the things that compliance is having to deal with.
So, I'm sorry, excuse me. I was just noting that's kind of funny because there's nothing in there about it.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, but to your point, Chris. Yeah, there are all sorts of agendas out there, right? And I believe that part of what's happening here is the domain name is the path of least resistance to eradicate bad behavior of some kind. You may have heard in the U.S. last week that the U.S. authorities managed to get VeriSign to remove 82 domain names that were infringing on intellectual property. So, it was entirely illegal behavior, and the authorities' move was entirely legal. But the domain name is such an easy way to get rid of something until it pops up under a new domain name later, that I think that's part of the reason you see so many people wanting to amend the RAA, because then they can use those tools to try to get rid of the behavior they don't care for.
Do you have that pressure as well, Rolf, on the actual domain name itself? Because, I mean, we certainly do. Just take the domain name away. That's easy. That'll fix the problem.
Yeah, we have that sometimes. And we get lots of questions of access to our registry data, not limited to our Whois data. Mm. But it's not been a call for changing our registrar agreements, for instance, or getting clauses into the agreements that might help in that sense. From our side, recently we added an abuse section in our registrar and also in our registrant contracts. But that was we were not forced or stimulated to do that. That was our own initiative.
Okay. John?
Thanks, Chris. This might be just a little bit off topic, but I thought it was probably worth just putting out there. It's my understanding that Across the African continent, there are, I think, two ICANN accredited registrars, and also in the Arab region, there are also no more than two ICANN registrars. There are, of course, obviously a number of reasons for that. I'm just wondering if there was any consideration in the process as to how ICANN might go to try and sort of start addressing that problem to have, you know, a more sort of global registrar community.
I mean, the short answer is no. I mean, I was on both work teams dealing with these proposed changes and amendments and the registered rights and responsibilities. At no time do I recall anybody ever raising that kind of issue. I mean, you're right. I mean, there aren't that many registrars, and I've even been approached by various board members and other people, you know, asking, can we help people in these regions? And for those of you who've been following the GNSO circus around the new TLDs, there was also a work group working on aiding financially and otherwise developing countries to get their own new TLDs. And it's an area, I think, that we'll probably see more developments there, especially if you look at, say, what's happening with who is for the IDNs and various other things, because, you know, a lot of the stuff is still presented very much in English.
Yeah. Mathieu had a question. Gabby, while the microphone's coming, see who's actually awake. How many CCTLD managers in the room actually have a model that has registrars? Fantastic. So while Matthew's asking his question, think about what's the biggest complaint you get about your registrars. Because it'd be interesting to know, because it's like, as you've said, right, transfers comes up, but actually this has almost nothing about transfers in there, which doesn't make any sense to me. Matthew.
Thanks, Chris. Good introduction to my question, actually. I would like to ask if any one of you could elaborate on one of the topics that was mentioned earlier about resellers. And I think it's related to the question about the barrier to entry to become a registrar, an ICANN-accredited registrar. And we see a lot of resellers on the French market, and a number of our registrars are resellers for generic temporal domains. And in terms of complaints we get from registrants, or even trademark holders, by the way, is the fact that the number of resellers is so high that consumers get confused about whose customer support they have to call, basically. So I'd be very interested to know if there was a problem statement in the reseller in identifying the reseller thing as a priority, and if there's anything underway to address it.
Well, the short answer is yes. It was one of the topics that came up, and part of the conversations we had was that people had kind of have this habit of throwing around the term reseller, but nobody had ever sat down and decided, you know, what exactly is a reseller. Now, for those of you sitting in the room who deal with in these relations, you might have an idea in your heads, but where do you actually draw the line? If I go on to say, okay, in France, of who's, let's say OVH, for example. If I go to the OVH website and I register a domain name to myself, then obviously I'm not reselling. But if I go onto the OVH website and I buy one domain for me, one domain for my sister, one domain for the person who lives down the street, and I let them use the domains, or maybe I charge them some kind of fee to use them, am I now a reseller? And one of the problems there was that if you have to start revealing a lot of data about your resellers, then what's to stop somebody from just doing it in that kind of that fashion? So they become, they're still reselling, but they're not doing it as overtly. I mean, some of the others here probably have more experience in that, but that was just the kind of discussions and debates that we had. And I'm not saying that there aren't problems, believe me. I mean, you know me well enough to know I'm not going to say that to you, Matthew, but, you know, it's actually defining what is that animal.
Yes. And also you have to decide how far down the tree you're going to go.
Well, yeah.
I mean, how far down are you going to go to try and regulate, for want of a better term?
Well, for example, in my company, we We deal with a lot of registrars for certain CCTLDs because they either don't want to carry them or can't deal with them. And then some of those registrars aren't dealing with the primary market. They're dealing primarily with resellers. Yeah. So there's layers and layers and layers.
But why be... Why, apart from the possibility of picking up your own names quicker or running whatever, why be a registrar? Isn't it got to be... Why not be a reseller? Is it because the prices are so tight?
Control and customer service. The two main reasons why we did it.
Right. Mason?
It'd be hard for me to speak to that. I mean, some of the largest registrars in the market today actually started out
as resellers, yeah.
And then they converted into an accreditation, and you know, for better control, more access to the policies that affect them, okay. A variety of reasons. But you're right; being a reseller would be very easy to do.
Yeah. And okay. Somebody want to first of all, are there any more questions? But does somebody want to say about? This is not about bashing registrars, but it's actually quite interesting to see what's out there. That may be causing a problem. Sometimes it is a problem. Sometimes it's not a problem, but it's just not been explained properly. Does somebody want to say what their most common complaint is or take a stab at it? Mary.
Thank you, Chris. My environment is the environment that you don't have accredited registrars and you have mostly the resellers. And most of the issues that the registrants raise are one, phishing problem, and registration abuse, trade name issues. We had a case where MTN Nigeria had somebody register mtnnigeria.com, and it's not a system. It wasn't from our registry, and they needed us to intervene. Sorry, I should have said that I'm on. I'm from .ng.
Well, you don't have to say that.
All right, okay.
I would have said it if you had.
All right, then. So there was this mtnnigeria.com, which is a trade name issue, and who registered it? It was just a reseller in my environment, and most people in my environment, they started off as web designers, website designers, and then they now started buying domain name for their customers, and some of them they will even register in their own name on behalf of the registrant, and sometimes we get complaints saying, okay, they've disagreed, and the domain name is not released to the rightful owners. Those are the things we have seen in our environment.
Yeah.
And then the second one, our registrars are complaining about the transfer fee, transferring from one register to the other. Those are
a fee for transfer.
Yeah, a fee for transfer.
Okay. You don't need to respond. Did you want to say something, Nigel?
No, I'm Mr. Mike now.
Oh, hello. John at the back there had his hand up. Just while that's happening, we're going to talk about AU, John?
No.
Okay, cool. So in Australia, I think probably the biggest complaint about resellers specifically, is that despite the fact that they're not allowed to, they put their own details in. And that's really hard. I'm genuinely trying to think of a complaint from registrants about registrars. We have heaps of complaints about our registrars, but actually from registrants about registrars, it's fairly rare. You'll occasionally get that. Well, I never received the reminder, but then of course to renew. But then of course you find out that actually that's because their email address is 4 years out of date, and that's why they didn't get it. Let John and then Leslie.
Thanks, Chris. I was just going to share, I guess, my opinion from my previous life working as a registrar. And I think one of the biggest pains that I used to have to deal with was the inconsistency in transfer processes between different TLDs, and that was a real headache. But another one was, and this to some extent applies to both AU and UK, although it was in the UK that I was working, was inflexibility in terms of license periods. So both AU and UK, for example, have a set two-year license period, and that does actually make designing bundled hosting products actually quite problematic when you're selling a hosting product for 12 months.
Or 12
and,
years.
Yeah, or 12, well, yeah, yeah, exactly. And having to sort of manage a domain renewal that's out of sync of that. That was one of the biggest pains I had.
Which, none of which is any of this has got anything to do with this stuff because it's not in there, right? So it's interesting. Yeah. Thank you, Johnny. Nigel, Sabine wanted to say something, but firstly.
I'm attempting to chair, but I can comment as well, I'm sure. For me, we have 3,000 registrars, and we do have quite a number of registrar complaints from time to time, and inevitably they link to actually a handful of registrars, in my experience. But that handful can upset an awful lot of registrants and take up an awful lot of registry time. And the problem
you don't
is
say.
Yeah, the problem is linked to the words accreditation, or a, you know, I'm a nominate registrar. So therefore, when a registrant is having problems, they expect to go to the relevant authority and have them dealt with. And certainly there is a push even within the UK for a changing of the nominate accreditation in order to deal with some of those undesirable behaviours. But there's also market forces in play, particularly with more information being shared about bad registrars, in effect. So, you know, I see huge changes in who's in my top 10 chart linked to poor customer service, where the word gets around very, very quickly. So I would say there's kind of a not a one-size-fits-all. There's not one contract solves everything. I think there's a mixture of contracts and market forces.
Sabina?
Yes, you have asked what the most complaints for from about registrars are. And I think in general we didn't receive quite a lot of, by the way, I have to say we are operating .de namespace, and I have to say in generally we didn't receive a lot of complaints about the registrars, and especially when I compare it with what Leslie says, I think when we receive complaints, then it's a lack of knowledge. So what we see is we operate the things in a highly automated manner, and we expect from people a certain amount of qualification. So and the less they are dealing with us, the more failures will occur. So what we have implemented that every registrar has to pass, has passed tests, and that actually helps a lot. It helps a lot because most of the registrars, from our perception, doesn't want to do a bad job, but they want to do things automatically, fast, and immediately. And the more they are trained, the more they know about the processes, and the more often they do it, the less failure actually will happen.
Yeah.
And I think that's something what we experience as key, that really people get a certain amount of knowledge. And that's actually what the value add for resellers are when they are buying from a DINIC registrar. That's that they get a little bit more of customer care, a little bit more of service, and a little bit more of explanation. And I think that's the value that the reseller, who is not so often actually dealing with us, is able to provide.
Thank you, Sabine. And Debbie was the last hand up.
Mind if I just...
No, you go ahead, absolutely.
It's actually interesting that Sabine brings that up, because I've noticed with dealing with various CCTLD registries. I mean, I'm not dealing directly with DNIC, but I know with Roloff's organization have it as well. They have a full registrar training thing. And under the 2009 RAA, there is a provision there for ICANN staff to provide a training... what's the word? How's it described? A training course? A training... function.
Training wheels?
Training wheels, yes, yeah. Thank you. To all registrars, and that's something which has been worked upon for the last year or so, and I think we should see that going live fairly soon.
Okay. Debbie?
We actually in .nz hold the registrar responsible for the actions of their resellers. So the biggest complaint that we actually get is the speed that some registrars, or the slowness with some registrars to actually step in and provide what we call our UDI, which is the transfer code, to the customer, because they don't want to, if you like, override their customer, which is, of course, the reseller. And so it's a case of educating the registrar that basically within a timely speed they've got to interrupt and actually provide the UDI. And I just want to comment that most of the ones we have problems with are the Australian-based registrars.
Thanks very much.
Just one coming back to what do you have a fixed time period for that, or do you use that kind of in a timely fashion type wording, or how is it done?
In our way, we don't specify the time frame because quite often, as Chris has pointed out, the registrant is the one that's at fault because their email information is out of date. And so, but we do then expect the registrar maybe to post it out. For example, if their address information is correct, and the registrar will refuse to actually update the email address for them in that particular situation, so we don't specify a time frame, but it's got to be timely.
You mean I can't update my information because the only authoritative way of me doing that is to use the email address that's in the database, and that's changed, so I can't update it. So the registrar and the registrar won't give me the password unless you send it to the email address. So I have to do a manual process in order to get that done. Yeah,
that's right. Because that's a possibility, we don't specify a time frame.
Okay, thank you, Roloff. And then we're going to wrap up and
okay,
pass
well
back to Leslie.
Okay, well, maybe first to answer your question. As far as I know, most of the complaints that we get from registrants about registrars have to do with either transfers or cancellations, domain deletes. And they're related because we don't have a specific solutions for registrars who don't get paid by their registrants. What registrars sometimes tend to do is either they don't collaborate when there's a transfer if their customer hasn't paid for the contract.
You mean for the domain name or you mean for an ancillary service?
Either case.
Right.
And very often it's the auxiliary service that is the highest amount, of course.
Of
the
course.
Domain is fairly cheap. Or they cancel the domain. And we say that that is only possible if they have in their contract with the registrant the explicit clause that they can cancel the domain or that they don't have to collaborate in a transfer in certain circumstances. And in all other cases, they act in force with our registrar contract, and they risk their own to lose their status as a registrar. And then I have a question for Debbie, because we have the same approach. We say our registrars are responsible for what their resellers do, and we always get back from our registrars, well, okay, that's fine if it's our official resellers, the organizations of which we know that they use us, registrar, to do reselling business. But they have the problem that there's a fair amount of parties that act as resellers, but they don't know it. They think it's just a registrant getting a lot of domains. And in fact, it's a reseller who has never told them that he is a reseller.
That he's actually holding them for something.
Yeah. And there clearly they don't want to accept responsibility for what that party does. So I wonder if you have the same problem and what your solution is then.
You make the registrar put it right. Yeah.
Oh, okay.
So that's what we do. If the reseller's got every name registered, names registered in their own names, then the registrar corrects. And the registrar's got, the first step is the registrar goes to the reseller and says, fix it. And if the reseller doesn't fix it, then we say to the registrar, well, sorry, but you need to fix it. And then they sack the reseller, and the reseller goes to someone else and does it all over again.
Yeah. Okay. So it's kind of a solution. Okay, thank you.
Yeah. Did you want to say something?
I was just actually in relation to this thing with the transfers. It's kind of interesting because as part of my work, I'm working with the GNSO on the transfer policies for ICANN. And it's kind of interesting that you're allowing them that level of flexibility, because within the GTLD space, you are very, very limited in how you can restrict a registrant. So if the registrant is paying you €100,000 a month for hosting, bandwidth, and everything else, and doesn't pay their bill, but their domain registration is still valid and hasn't expired, you are bound under the terms of the REA to give them the EPP code to unlock the domain and to let them go away. And even though that domain name is the only way that you have to actually hold them to the other contract.
Well, you have the contract to hold them to the contract.
I don't know if I make myself clear. It's the same with us, unless the registrar has in his agreement, his contract with the registrant, a clause that he can cancel the...
Yeah, but I can put whatever the hell I like into my agreement with my registrant, but my ICANN REA overrides that.
Yes.
So it's completely irrelevant. I can put in my contract that I will give all my registrants cups of coffee on a Friday, but that doesn't have anything to do with the REA.
Well, that's a good idea, though.
Well, so I think it is as well.
As a USP, it's fantastic.
That enforces the impression that these amendments are not about...
Well, I had no clue where this was going, but it just seems to me that...
The thing is, a lot of the stuff that is on that list is stuff that has come from, law enforcement. And some of that... And the stuff that's coming from law enforcement is because it's coming from somewhere else. And some of it is genuine, and it's stuff that should be worked on. There's other things, though, that have ended up on the original wash list. And if you saw the original list... I mean, my God, it was 150-odd line items. Some of them were things that had already been dealt with in policies, two, 3 years ago, but the advocates hadn't bothered keeping up. There were other things that were covered in the 2009 REA, but they hadn't bothered checking to see the differences between the two documents. There were things that ICANN's compliance team may not have been addressing in the past, but had been addressing in the previous 6 months. Mm. So there's this ridiculously long list. So myself, Mason, I think Mason, you were involved at some point, Staten, Paul, various of the others, and ICANN's team were kind of working through this list, going backwards and forwards, and we dumped a load of stuff off it because it was just insane.
Well, I'm gonna hand you back to Leslie. All I would say is that maybe. You can usefully get some weight from what we do in the CCTLD world with registrars to take into your battle.
Thank you, Chris. That seems to be the missing element of this discussion, actually, learning from some of the things that have worked or maybe haven't worked within the CC community. So I think what we've heard today is obviously this is partway through a rather long process by the sounds of it, but in practice there may well be significant numbers of changes to the RIA if all of those things work through and are agreed. We'll see. I think it's a watch this space. I think we've identified there are some very common behaviours across CCs and also in the G space, which is of no surprise to anyone, I'm sure. I think I've also heard some pushback against the contract as a vehicle for dealing with those changes. So I guess I would query if the science of compliance is actually the answer to some of these issues. Any final comments from panel members? Stratton?
I just want to say thank you very much for having me. I've never been at a CCNSO meeting before, and so it was really delightful to be here and hear your perspectives, which I think will help us in our conversations with ICANN compliance and others. Thank you very much.
Got it.
And kind of echoing what Staten was saying, I was in other CCNSO sessions this week, but I think it is very, very useful for all of us if there are more communications between the people working within the CCTLD space and those of us who work also within the G space. Because, I mean, let's face it, we're all dealing with exactly the same things. There's no difference. In a CCTLD, you may have specific rules, but your customers are our customers. There's no real difference.
Mason?
Thank you for having us. I learned a lot today, and I hope our contributions were helpful.
Roloff? final comments. Okay, so please can you join me in thanking Margie? I will pass our thanks on. Roloff, Mason, Mackay, and Staten. Thank you.
Okay, we're done. We have a council meeting in half an hour. You're all very welcome, but we will understand if you don't come back.